The Way Out Podcast, episode 97.
My grandfather really became a pretty central figure in my life for that time. And now, you know, we fast forward to when I was 10 years old. In that moment, my grandfather started touching me where he shouldn't. I basically dissociated, and I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time. I only know that now, looking back, but I totally checked out and went numb.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us on this week's installment of The Way Out, sharing stories from people just like you who have recovered from alcoholism and other addictions. The Way Out does not speak on behalf of, nor are we affiliated with any 12-step organization. Our purpose is to share with you, one episode at a time, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now.
The Way Out Podcast is sponsored by Transitions Daily. Would you like to join a free, anonymous, online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. Don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Make sure to check out the official website of The Way Out Podcast at www.wayoutcast.com. There you will find links to our latest episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Radio FM. You can also follow The Way Out Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Help us get the message out that lifelong recovery from alcoholism and addiction is possible by giving us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform.
Have a question or comment about an upcoming or previous show? Call us right now. Area code 218-382-1960. We're going to start featuring your comments and questions on the podcast. Call us anytime, day or night, and leave us a message on whatever is on your mind. Maybe it's a previous episode topic or something that you're struggling with in your own recovery. Call us at 218-382-1960 and leave the Way Out Podcast hosts a message and we could feature it on our next episode. That's 218-382-1960. Help us recover out loud. The Way Out Podcast is on right now. I'm your host, Charlie L. This week, I'm over the moon to have had the opportunity to have an engaging discussion with Rachel Grant. Rachel is an expert and survivor, check that, a beyond survivor of sexual abuse, and has a powerful message of hope and recovery to share with us. Many of us in the recovery community have had sexual abuse in our own histories, or know someone who has. This special episode of The Way Out Podcast brings this subject to the fore and offers a way out, if you will, through Rachel's Beyond Survival program of recovery. Listen up.
So, I would love if you could introduce yourself to the Way Out Podcast audience, share a little bit about who you are, and then we can dig into a little bit of your story.
Awesome. Thank you, Charlie. So good to be here with you all. Hello, everybody who's listening. I'm Rachel Grant, and I'm a sexual abuse recovery coach. And all that really means is I work with men and women who have experienced childhood sexual abuse, who are really just sick and tired of feeling broken and unfixable and burdened. And I help them break free from the pain of the past so they can move on with their lives and live a good life and live a life that is them as their authentic, most wonderful, most beautiful, most awesome self.
You know, that's an amazing way to introduce yourself to our community, Rachel. When we talk about being locked in chains and really being in bondage over a certain part of ourselves and a part of our lives, addicts and alcoholics can really identify with that. And certainly there's been a lot of trauma in many of the stories that we've shared here on the Way Out Podcast. Yeah. And that's been an integral part of much of what's been shared over the last 97 episodes of the Way Out podcast. And so what a great opportunity to be able to address this issue that comes up so often, really in and of itself in an entire episode. So Rachel, tell us about how sexual abuse and trauma affected you in your life.
Yeah, thank you for that opportunity to share my story. So when I was 5 years old, my grandfather came to live with our family. I grew up in a little town in Oklahoma, so I'm a country chick. And I had an older brother and sister who really didn't pay me any attention. So I was super excited about this new person in our home. I thought, captive audience, right? And he was, you know, he was somebody who I ran home to see, you know, after school and went straight to his room and, you know, we'd play and hang out and watch TV and color and read books and all of that. So my grandfather really became a pretty central figure in my life for that time. And now, you know, we fast forward to when I was 10 years old. One day we were sitting out on the front porch swing like we often did. We lived right across from this beautiful park and so loved, you know, just watching the birds and talking and seeing the kids playing in the park there. And it was like any other day for the most part. I was snuggled up next to him. I always loved this orange and red sweater that he wore. It was super fuzzy. I don't know why I loved it so much, but I did. And so in that moment, my grandfather started touching me where he shouldn't. And I remember thinking, Charlie, that he just didn't realize what he was doing. And so I started to shift my body and try to move out of the way. But he gripped a hold of me tighter. And it was one of those moments where you don't know what's going on. You know, I'm a 10-year-old girl. I haven't had any sexual experiences. I'm just coming into my body and these sorts of things. And I basically dissociated. And I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time. I only know that now, looking back. But I totally checked out and went numb. And when I finally kind of snapped to, I jumped up from the swing and I ran to my parents' bedroom and I was crying and I was upset. And, you know, I think every time I look back at that particular moment, it always strikes me just how immediate we are in our heads about these sorts of experiences and how quickly we as children, because we're ego-based, as we should be as children, but because of that, we quickly make things about us. What did I do? I must have done something bad. There's something wrong with me.
You say, Rachel, you disassociated, and I want to maybe just pause and explore that a moment because, you know, often when there's trauma, addicts and alcoholics for sure aren't always real connected with their feelings and their emotions. And it's a fairly common experience for a recovering alcoholic or addict not to be in touch with their emotions or their feelings when it comes to many experiences, but certainly traumatic ones. Can you maybe explain what it really means to disassociate and what that experience is like? Maybe that helps us as a Way Out podcast community to, you know, understand that better.
Absolutely. So we want to think about dissociation as a spectrum. So it's everything from kind of spacing out and daydreaming, which is actually a very healthy, normal dissociation. The brain actually cannot stay fully engaged, fully present 100% of the time. Our head would explode. And so those little times where we like space out and like, oh, wait, what was I just doing? Or daydreaming, that's actually a really healthy type of dissociation. And then the other end of that spectrum is all the way to DID, dissociative identity disorder, where a person is experiencing such extreme trauma that a part of their consciousness, they kind of shut down, and another part of their consciousness takes over in the experience. And so the type of dissociation I was experiencing was kind of like in the middle there, where you are present-ish, you kind of have a sense of what's going on, but you also have this kind of numbness. It's like a spacey kind of feeling. And basically what's happening is, on a neurological level, your system has been escalated to a point of trauma, and your response system is so overwhelmed by that that it can't fight. It can't run. And the only option left to it is to freeze and kind of play dead. So when you hear that, you know, the triad, the fight, flight, freeze, pretty common, right? The freeze is actually the same as dissociation. And that most commonly occurs when either we don't feel like we have the capacity to fight or run, or the system gets so overwhelmed that it's almost like you have, it's like a short circuit in your system, and you know, everything kind of blitzes out for a moment. And that can last every, you know, anywhere from a few seconds to hours.
So it's actually a self-protection measure that your body...
Absolutely.
...and your brain executes on, so that you're not overwhelmed by this experience that you don't have the ability to process.
Yeah, it's like taking away all of your senses in some ways, so that you're not able to feel and experience the things that are happening to you, because to be fully conscious of that, would just be too traumatic.
Too overwhelming. So tell me, Rachel, what happens after this initial traumatic experience? You begin this process of, something's wrong with me, maybe I did something to cause it, maybe I acted in a certain way to bring on this kind of behavior, there's something broken, wrong inside of me that caused this.
Yeah.
And tell me how that manifested itself as this continued, as you grew older. Did the abuse continue?
Yeah, the abuse continued for some time, and it got worse. And in all likelihood, the abuse actually happened before I was 10 years old. But I usually mark it at 10 because that's when I have the most conscious memory of abuse happening. So here I am, you know, 10 years old. My whole life has kind of been turned upside down. I don't know what to do about this. I don't know what to say about this. I have a complete sense that it's my fault, that I'm doing something to cause this, and that I have to figure it out on my own. And so as time is passing, I'm just sitting with all of those hard feelings, and I'm being re-traumatized, of course. I'm coming home to a non-safe space anymore. One day, my mom happened to be walking by the window that looked out onto the porch, and she saw what my grandfather was doing. And she came running out onto the porch and was like, "Rachel, get in here!" Ooh, in her like best, like, "Rachel, you're in trouble" voice, right? Which in that moment, as a 10-year-old, that's what I really felt. Like, I'm in trouble now. Whereas, of course, now as an adult, I can look back at the experience and realize that she was scared and worried and trying to get me away and all those things. And so they, my parents, immediately got my grandfather out of the house, which I'm extremely thankful for. I know, having worked with survivors for over 11 years now, that that's not always the case. And that can certainly add another layer of healing that has to be done. But what I noticed, Charlie, was that even though my grandfather was physically gone, whew, man, like the impact of what had happened was not. It was still there with me. And, you know, my parents, they tried. They wanted me to go to counseling. They even managed to get my butt in the seat a couple of times, but I was not having it. I was like, "You want me to talk about what? You want me to sit here across from this guy I don't know and say what?" You know, so I just put up a wall and I shut it all down. And then pretty much for the next, you know, 16 years of my life, I was in this process of trying to figure it all out, But because I wasn't getting any support, because I didn't have any way of understanding the experience, I was acting out in all sorts of ways, right? I didn't understand how to navigate relationships. I didn't understand how to trust people. I took a lot out on myself and, you know, eventually found myself in an abusive relationship for 10 years. Certainly my sense of who I was and my confidence and all of that was, you know, really deeply impacted by this experience. So if we fast forward to my mid-20s, you know, post-suicide attempts, post-struggling with food addictions, you know, all of these things are happening to me, and no sense of self-worth, and going through a divorce now, which, you know, thank be to the gods for getting me out of that relationship. But it left me in this place of, you know, in a new apartment with nothing but a sleeping bag and a lamp, right? My life had been stripped down in such a strong way. And I was sitting there one night and I had this, I'm going to curse, oh fuck moment. Right, I just thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? Maybe some of you all have had a moment like that. I bet I'm not alone, you know, in that experience.
That is a very common experience against amongst the recovering, for sure.
That's right. And, you know, I had this really strong voice in my head that said, you know, Rachel, you have got to get your shit together. If you do not do something like right now, you are going to spend the rest of your life just broken and miserable and just trying to get by, but not really living. And so it's really in that moment, Charlie, when I became obsessed with answering this question of how do I heal from sexual abuse?
You know, it's something, Rachel, that I want to touch on. Did you feel for any period or an extended period or throughout the time that you were plagued by the aftermath of the abuse that you were unfixable, that you were somehow permanently broken, somehow there, you were not going to ever be able to be okay, that you were going to feel like you felt for the rest of your life? Did you feel like that? Was there that hopelessness about your life and circumstances?
Yeah, most definitely. I think that was self-imposed in many ways, but I also came across people who were reinforcing that message, unfortunately. You know, I definitely felt broken. I definitely felt like there was something different about me and something wrong with me and something that needed to be fixed. And in my early 20s, I did start having those conversations and did start opening up about the abuse and started therapy. One day I was in the therapist office and I was having a really rough day. It was one of those like, why bother? This is never going to change. I can't do this anymore kind of days. Mm-hmm. And I said to my therapist, is there ever going to be a day when I just wake up and feel normal? Mm. And my therapist said, no, you're always going to be this way. You're always going to struggle with the stuff. You're always going to be, you know, having difficulties because of the trauma you experienced. And I don't know how I found the resourcefulness in that moment to do this, but I looked up at him and I said, you're fired.
Yeah!
I didn't have a lot of backbone back then, but in that moment I sure did. And I said, that sounds wrong to me. Like, I don't know what the right answer is, but I know the wrong answer when I hear it. And that just, man, it was so terrible. And I think that's one of the things, not to get too far ahead of myself, but, you know, one of the reasons why I do the work that I do and one of the messages that I'm so committed to is really helping people understand this is not a life sentence. You are not so broken that you can't heal. And I think that was a big part of my journey at that turning point was really deciding to say, to hell with everything I've been told about this. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to pursue this from a different angle and see if I can come up with some different answers.
It's interesting you call that oh fuck moment. And, you know, for me, I refer to it as the gift of desperation I was given by the God of my understanding, my higher power, who I didn't believe in at the time at all. This gift of desperation, I was finally desperate enough to do whatever it took to start to get better, whatever that meant.
Yeah.
Can you relate to that?
100%. 100%. It was like, it's either do this or surrender, really. Being the stubborn redhead that I am, surrender doesn't usually come into play. So with that obsession, I started that path to healing. I started reading everything I could, studying. I did my master's in counseling psychology. I started to study neuroscience so I could understand the impact of trauma on the brain and the nervous system. And I started talking to, you know, professionals and experts and all of that. And in another life, I've had a lot of different hats in my journey, and one of them was as an educator, a teacher. And so my mind kind of tends towards curriculum. So as I was doing this work and putting the pieces together for myself and kind of coming to, oh, this works for that, or oh, this little thing over here helps with that, my brain just kind of naturally started formulating it into a system. And so bit by bit, I was putting these pieces together and drawing on all these different elements, my experience, my education, the research that I was doing, and that all came into being what is now today called the Beyond Surviving Program.
Is that a program that you developed?
Yeah, 100%.
We're going to talk about that. I love it. I love this idea that, you know, one of the things that you just said, which is really parallels my experience in recovery and in recovery in general, those who have been able to recover from drug and alcohol addiction, sounds like you stopped trying to do it all by yourself. It sounds like you stopped trying to live and deal with it only within and of yourself, that you surrendered and you started to ask for help and you started to seek knowledge. And most importantly, it sounds like you started to take some action.
Yeah, big time. That's exactly it. I started turning my attention to people who I thought could guide me and be mentors to me. I started reading just everything I possibly could. I started surrounding myself with people who were in this conversation and wanting to bring about change. And I definitely leaned on my friends and my family as I was navigating this, and got good people in my life who really saw in me what I couldn't even yet see myself.
And so you started surrounding yourself with not only like-minded people, but it sounds like people. Did you engage with people that had, for lack of a better term, recovered from similar trauma?
Yeah, I think that in the reading that I was doing, that's really where I came into contact with them the most. And then I think there were mentors back. That was back in the day. I was in church quite a bit then, not so much today. But I think, you know, Joyce Myers was a real powerful voice for me at that time in my journey. And reading books by Peter Levine and Bessel van der Kolk, I came across Dan Siegel's work in my master's program. He's does a lot of work in the neuroscience field. So all of that started adding up and supporting me in, you know, finding my way, you know, out of this, you know, out of this muck, really, and the mess that was my life. And so pretty quickly, I've always been one of those people where I put the cart before the horse a lot of times. And sometimes that's not a good thing, but sometimes it is. So I didn't wait until I had like all of the training. I didn't wait until I had the master's degree, because I had this real strong sense that I had an intuition for what this was. So in 2007, I went to the care pastor at the church that I was attending at the time, and I said, you know, I know there are other women here who have experienced sexual abuse, and I think I have something that can help them. I think that I have a path forward. And at that time, I was actually using a curriculum developed by Cynthia Kubitin called Shelter from the Storm. So that's a faith-based workbook about healing from sexual abuse. And so we put together, you know, a group of women, and I was using that as my main guide, but I was already starting to bring in other pieces of what I thought would make an impact and be helpful and needed to be, you know, worked on in this healing journey. And so I actually did that in that format for 3 years before that launched me into doing my master's. And I even went so far as to reach out to Cynthia and say, you know, I really like your curriculum, but I think it limits, you know, people because it's faith-based. Oh my gosh. You know, only...
How did she respond to that, I wonder?
She said, let me pray about it. I said, well... Okay. You know, it's kind of one of those moments where, like, I knew in my gut I needed to write my own book. I needed to write my own curriculum, but I was dodging it, right? I wasn't sure that I really had it, had what it took. And so, you know, thank God for that door closing, because it absolutely forced me to lean in to my experience and my wisdom. And of course, I'm drawing on her teachings and the teachings of all of the experts and mentors that I've come along in the past. So I'm sharing that. And I'm also, you know, have brought in things that I think are just uniquely mine, things that skills and tools and strategies that came about as a way of me trying to find my way.
This week's Recovery Revealed segment is brought to you by All Recovery Rings and AllRecoveryRings.com. Would you like a medallion or coin from your favorite recovery program, hand-forged into a beautiful ring? Go to AllRecoveryRings.com and choose from over 15 stunning styles, all hand-forged by expert craftsmen. What are you waiting for? Do like I did and get your very own recovery ring today. We'll be right back to the second half of my interview with Rachel as we pause for this week's edition of Recovery Revealed. After nearly 100 episodes of the Way Out podcast, we're shaking this thing up. I'm adding two new co-hosts to the mix. We're going to start featuring your questions and comments on the podcast. Call us anytime, day or night, and leave us a message on whatever is on your mind. Maybe it's a previous episode topic or something that you're struggling with in your own recovery. Call us at 218-382-1960. And leave the Way Out podcast hosts a message, and we could feature it on our next episode. My two new co-hosts and I produced a video promo, which you can see on our Facebook page, talking about the new format. And I've got the audio queued up for you right now. I couldn't be more excited to bring you a preview of what the next 100 episodes of the Way Out podcast are going to sound like. Listen up.
Hi, Charlie with the Way Out podcast. We're bringing you a completely new and reinvented Way Out podcast, where we're bringing you more voices, one of them being my dog. And what we want to do is we want to bring as many voices to the Way Out podcast community as possible. The more voices that we can bring, the more voices that are recovering out loud together, talking about the issues that are important to you, the better off we all are as a recovery community. So let's recover out loud together. I've got two amazing co-hosts joining me in the Way Out podcast for the next 100 episodes, Jason and Alex, who bring some amazing perspectives, some amazing experience, strength, and hope. And we're going to bring that to you in a way that makes sense for you, the listener. To that end, here is my first new co-host, Jason.
What's up? My name is Jason Rudine. I'm going to be one of the new co-hosts on the Way Out. I think that this is going to be amazing. We're going interactive. We're going to bring all these fresh perspectives from the community, and not just the recovery community. Anybody can call and talk to us. We would love to hear from family and supporters of people, those that are touched by addiction, you know, we need to get this thing widespread, man. This is a conversation.
Don't forget, the way we get the message out to those who still suffer is to give this podcast a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform.
So tell me about the system. Let's hear the name of the system again, and tell me, let's walk through it a little bit. Give me the 1,000-foot overview of the system.
Well, so what I really thought about a lot when I was developing this program, again, first of all, it was just me trying to get my shit together. I didn't even know it was a program, right? I was just trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together in my life. But as that started to continue to unfold and I got more encouragement from friends and family, like, hey, what if this could help other people? What if what worked for you could translate to help others? I sat down and I started to work it out. There were a couple of things that were on my mind when I started. First, I wanted to try to find a way to break down the process of healing from abuse and trauma into bite-sized chunks, like doable. Like, oh, because when, you know, for me, I would sit in the therapist's office and I'd be like, well, I'm having trouble with sex. Well, I'm having trouble with food. Well, I'm having trouble with relationships. I don't know what to do with my career. I feel like I can't communicate my needs. I don't even know how I feel. And it was like this, you know, onslaught of problems, right? And symptoms. I just would get so overwhelmed by even thinking about how do I even begin to approach this thing. So I knew that one of the key pieces of this was, how do I break that down for people so it starts to feel doable? It stops feeling like this overwhelming, insurmountable, you know, mountain that one has to climb. The other thing I got really curious about was I started thinking about trauma and abuse like an injury. And I thought, well, what are the protocols that people usually use when there's an injury? Like, say you break a leg. It's very clear what to do, right? You yell and scream, ow. People run over, they help you, they get you to the hospital. The doctor then has a process, right, that they go through. And they know we need to do this, and then we need to do this, and then we need to do this. And the doctor never says, oh, it's a broken leg. Well, let me think about how to approach this today. Like it's a brand new thing, right?
Right.
Like they've never seen it before.
Right.
And I thought, okay, one of the things that I keep running into is this idea that it's not linear. Healing from abuse is not this straightforward thing. And I thought, well, maybe that's true, but what if it's not? What if that's not actually true and trauma is an injury that can also be healed in a similar way to any other type of injury? And so, long story short, I began to think about the order of operations and experiment with that. What do we need to do first? What comes second? Ooh, if I tried to work with people around this piece over here, but we haven't put this piece in place, I'll give you an example. So a lot of people come to me because they feel isolated and disconnected in their lives. They've completely pushed everyone away. They don't have any support. They don't have any relationship. Now, that's a core need and a core problem. But what I noticed over and over again was that if we tried to jump right into working with that, but we hadn't resolved shame, it never really worked. Because I could say to somebody, look, go join some meetup groups. Go do this thing. Go, you know, build some relationships. But at the core, you feel like you're not good enough. You're not deserving. And you don't know how to set or keep boundaries because shame definitely impairs that, you're not going to be able to build connections. So that's what I mean. I just started thinking about the order. So in the Beyond Surviving program, we start out with a boot camp for the brain. It's so critical that we learn to regulate our nervous system. You know, anybody struggling with addiction, there's something going on there that your system can't cope. And so you use drugs or alcohol to cover it up, to numb it out, to escape that. And when you don't feel like you can manage that anxiety, when you don't feel like you can manage those triggers, when you don't feel like you have a handle on your system, you're going to turn to something else to help you with that. And so when we work on a neurological level to retrain the brain, and to heal the nervous system, then we move out of a place of dysregulation and into a place of regulation, and we have more resiliency, more capacity to cope, so we can take on all of those underlying yucky stuffs that are causing us to run away to the drugs or alcohol or TV or sex or whatever it is in the first place.
So it's about coping strategies, it sounds like, right? In the beginning, we're in recovery lingo, we call that, we put tools in our toolbox.
Yep.
And instead of making the choice that I'm going to pick up to drink, I'm going to make a phone call, or I am going to go to a meeting, or I am going to read some recovery literature or something of that. I've got tools in my toolbox. I can pray, I can meditate, I can, go for a walk. I've got a lot of tools in my recovery toolbox, especially at the beginning, that I can draw from that says, I'm feeling like I want to drink or I want to use. Well, what that really means is something else is going on,
mm-hmm.
that I don't know how to deal with. And the only way I know how to deal with that is to drink or use.
Yeah.
And so instead of hitting the proverbial eject button, I am going to use one of these coping tools. One of the other things I found tremendously interesting, Rachel, is there's a guy that we know pretty well in the 12-step program called Bill W.
Sure.
And, you were explaining how you were coming across, how you came to put together Beyond Surviving. And you said something really, really, I think, powerful. You said, I wasn't trying to create a program, I was just trying to fucking get better.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Bill W. was doing the same thing. Like, he wasn't trying to create Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't trying to create the 12 steps. That wasn't the idea. He was desperately trying to get better, and he started using these principles from other organizations, the Oxford Group, and from a number of different other organizations, and built out this program of recovery, right?
Yeah.
And so I just thought that uniquely paralleled your experience in terms of putting together Beyond Surviving.
Thanks, yeah.
It was for you.
That's super cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually didn't know that about him, about how he came to create and formulate. So that's super fun. Yeah, absolutely.
It is.
Yeah.
So as you put together these coping tools, we need to shed shame. That was important in my own recovery. I think that's important in most recovering addicts and alcoholics. It's got to be important from beyond surviving trauma and sexual abuse, the shame piece that, and maybe you could explain to the Way Out podcast audience the difference between shame and guilt.
Mm.
Because I think they get associated
together,
and they're so very different.
They are. They are. So in the Beyond Surviving world, shame equals taking responsibility for something that you are not responsible for.
Mm.
So it's like you see someone walking across the street, and they trip and fall down, and your gut response is, oh, I should have done something to stop that.
Mm.
If we take it into the realm of actual abuse, shame is, this is my fault. I caused this to happen. There's something that I did. There's something that I said. There's something about who I am. There's something about what I needed that caused this abuse experience to happen. And so as soon as we take on the responsibility of somebody else's choices, we immediately are going to generate shame because we have to explain why. Well, it must be because I'm bad. It must be because I'm no good. It must be because I'm unlovable, right? All of that is shame. Yeah.
What a great way to think about that and explain it. I heard it explained to me one time that guilt is, I feel guilty if I broke a vase or I, drove in somebody's lawn. That's guilt. Shame is, I feel bad about me as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I am, there's something broken, wrong and unlovable about me as a person.
And the cause of that, what causes that, is the taking responsibility of something that doesn't belong.
I deserved this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so exactly right. The opposite there is guilt, which is taking responsibility for something you're actually responsible for. So you stick your foot out and you trip someone, right? You feel guilty. You feel bad. And the nice thing about guilt is that it can be alleviated through apologizing or making amends. Whereas shame, that can't happen. It's kind of like this. Like I give a little example. Like one of my clients said to me, well, Rachel, the abuse is my fault because I would come home from school and I would go to my room and I'd play my music really loud. I loved music and I loved, you know, cranking it up. And I knew, though, that my mom didn't like me to play the music that loud. And inevitably, she would come into my room and beat me up. I caused this, Rachel. If I just didn't play the music, none of that would happen. When we look at an experience like that, it's really important to get clear about whose choices belong to who. And I think that's one of the most complex things about healing from trauma and abuse, is that it all becomes very collapsed. It's very easy to say, well, this came before this, so this caused this. And so in my work, one of the things that I'm supporting survivors in doing is separating that out and saying, look, you played the music loudly. So yeah, you're responsible for that part. That's the guilt part. You made that choice. You're guilty. You can make amends for that. But the she hit me part, mom made that choice. And you can't apologize for that. That would be like saying, mom, I'm sorry you hit me. Like, when you put it like that, doesn't that just sound like crazy 100%. Pants?
100%. Right? 100%.
Yeah, and so, you know, the thing about shame and the thing about taking the blame for abuse is that one thing I love for people to understand is that you did the right thing to take the blame when you were a kid because it helped you survive.
So important. That is so important. And I love that you brought that up, Rachel, that we tend to beat ourselves up for the way that we handled situations, traumatic situations in the past, and judge ourselves constantly for using drugs and alcohol when we were younger in our youth. And I gotta say that we didn't know any better.
That's right.
You didn't know any better. That person going through that traumatic experience was doing the best that they knew how. And yeah, it was not a great coping strategy, but it's the only thing that you had.
Yeah, absolutely, Charlie. We call that retrospective thinking. You know, when we look back at experiences from where we are in the present day and we judge them based on what we know now today, and we shame and we blame and we make ourselves wrong, it's like looking at a little, you know, little person and getting upset with them because they don't know how to drive a car. Well, hell, they don't know how to drive a car. They've never had the experience, you know? Like, why would you yell at a child for not knowing how to drive a car? But we do this to ourselves so much, and then it reiterates those messages of shame, and it just keeps us in that cycle. And so when we can find that place of self-compassion that says, look, it was, you know, survival that I blamed myself rather than my parents, because it would have been just too much for my system to imagine that the people taking care of me were also harming me, right? Me turning to drugs or alcohol or whatever it was to help me move through and survive that moment. I made those choices based on the knowledge and the experience and the resources that I had at the time. That's okay. We can have.
So we shed that shame, right? And that's so important to shed that shame, right? I can't tell you how many times I felt like I needed to apologize for just being me.
Sure, yeah.
Right? And I think that's an experience that other folks can really identify with. Not I'm sorry for breaking this. Not I'm sorry for saying that. I'm sorry for being me, right?
Yeah.
For just being here, for existing. Clearly, I'm a giant piece of shit that deserves this kind of treatment. So we move through the shame. What are the next steps in order to get to a place where we're not just surviving this anymore?
Right.
We're living again.
So from there, we start to look at the building connections piece. So how do we start coming out of isolation? Because we cannot heal in isolation. We need community. We need relationship. And all of those feelings of I don't belong, I'm different, that keep us separate. So we begin to resolve that. From there, we now have a great emotional and social platform to build upon and do work around the emotional life. We can take on things like anxiety and fear and anger. We can start to express the feelings that are wrapped up around the experience of trauma and abuse. From there, we can really start to build confidence. So there's like this clearing that happens when you start to name and feel your feelings, and you start to let go of holding on to things that are not yours to hold on to, and you start to reframe who you think you are and what you think you're capable of. That confidence starts to build and starts to grow, and then from there, we can start to look at how to have healthy relationships. How do we trust?
It's amazing you say name and feel your feelings, mm-hmm. Rachel, because if I don't know what that feeling is, but it feels really, really awful, and I don't know what to do with it, and I don't know what it is, I like to, historically, before recovery, I would just squish it down, mm-hmm. and squish it down, yeah. and squish it down, because it's scary.
Yeah.
And the last time I had really overwhelming feelings, It wrecked me for a week,
yeah.
right? And so I don't want to have those overwhelming feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just squish them down and squish them down. But when we start having a community of support and some coping mechanisms and that shame is shed, we feel safe enough to start naming those feelings. And then maybe we realize that those feelings aren't necessarily overwhelming. They just seemed that
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
They just seemed overwhelming.
Yeah.
They just threatened to be overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a beautiful example of what you just laid out there of why I do things in a particular order. You know, sometimes people come to me and say, well, can't we just work on this piece? Or can't we? I'm like, you know, you can do that with someone else, but not with me.
Sure.
Because quite honestly, I see people getting re-traumatized over and over again because of stuff like that. Being pushed to feel their anger, express their anger before they have the system regulation tools in place, before they have that confidence, before they've released that shame, you know, all of that. Absolutely. So,
and as recovering people, many of us work 12 steps, and you have to do the steps in order to get better. That's just the way it is, right? Like I gotta do them in order. If I do them out of order, it's not gonna work.
Same
so, us recovering alcoholics and addicts can definitely embrace an order of operations.
That's right.
I can tell you that.
Yeah. And, you know, ultimately, the idea here is once we've built up those relationship skills of trust and intimacy and vulnerability and communication, you know, ultimately, I think relationships are the heart of the human experience. And so if we are not navigating relationships in a healthy, powerful way, I don't think that we can live in a healthy, powerful way. All of that ultimately adds up to being able to really reconnect with your authentic, genuine self. And all I mean by that is you get to be the person you were meant to be before any of that bullshit happened to you. And you go out.
And I love that because that authentic, genuine self sounds like pop psychology, but really the bottom line is most of us can identify, especially those of us who are recovering from drug or alcohol addiction, that the gap, the chasm, the canyon between who we were before we started to recover and the people we thought we might be able to be at one point of our lives was so big, was so spacious that we didn't think that it was able to be achieved. Like, that person's gone. The person I thought I could be that ship has sailed long, long ago, and I've fallen tragically short of that. And the reality is, if we do some certain things in a certain order, and we're committed to it,
yeah,
that the people that we are meant to be, the people that, if you're spiritual like I am, my higher power wants me to be, is far and away more than I ever thought possible.
Mm.
Far and away more than I thought possible.
Yeah.
And that, Rachel, is the, for me, the miracle. Yeah. That's the piece that is beyond spectacular, is when we are able to go through this process of recovery beyond surviving and experience a life we didn't think possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, being on the other side and living in that space now, I mean, honestly, there are days where I'm like, wow, life is kind of boring over here. But I'm glad. I'm glad for the boring.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. And I remember, so anybody who's listening though, you know, we're all at different stages in that journey. And I remember being in that place where if I'd heard somebody saying this, I would have been like, yeah, that's bullshit. Like, I can't even imagine that. I can't even connect to that. And so I'm just here to just say, you know, like, wow, I really get that. And I hope that you can draw on, you know, my experience, Charlie's experience, and just find a little piece of hope, because that's all we need. We just need a little crack in that door between, you know, there's going to be the part of you that says, yeah, right, it's not possible, I don't know if, but find in yourself that part of you that also says, I wonder, I'm curious, what if? And that can be the part that propels you forward to take those little steps that will ultimately lead you to the place where you're on the other side of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about, Rachel. What a great way to end the show in this idea that maybe, just maybe, I can get better too. Maybe, just maybe, I'm not permanently damaged, permanently broken, irreparable and unlovable. Maybe, just maybe, I can get better too. And that, Rachel, is all we need. Mm-hmm. It's just a sliver of hope and a sliver of willingness, okay? And a sliver of open-mindedness. If we have a little bit of hope, a little bit of willingness, and just a little bit of open-mindedness, boy, some amazing things can happen.
No doubt.
In our lives.
No doubt.
Rachel, how can the Way Out podcast community connect with you if they would like to learn more about what you do?
Awesome. Thank you, Charlie. Please come visit me at rachelgrantcoaching.com. One of the things I'll recommend that you do when you get to the website is check out my 3 stages of recovery checklist. It's right there at the bottom. It's a really great place to start. It's going to help you identify where you are on this journey, what kind of goals to set based on each stage, and what kind of resources and support to get based on which stage of healing you're in.
Oh, what a great resource that you have available. Give me the website again, because I love free resources. I love resources that can help people help themselves.
Right on. Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, Grant, G-R-A-N-T, coaching.com.
And that'll be in the show notes as well, so I'll make sure that Rachel's website is in the show notes. So if you can't remember it, you're walking, you're exercising, you're cooking dinner, and you can't get it down, it's going to be in the show notes. Rachel, I can't thank you enough for the time, for being on the Way Out podcast. What a great, 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 great and powerful interview.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you for being a part of The Way Out, where we share stories from people just like you who have recovered from alcoholism and other addictions. If you would like to reach out to the show, you can visit us on the web at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. Or drop your host a friendly email at share@wayoutcast.com. There you could also find links to previous episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podcast Garden. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the podcast, contact me at share@wayoutcast.com. See you next time. And remember, if you don't change, your sobriety day will.